From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, the Trump administration has made cuts to the National Weather Service, but disasters like deadly flooding in Texas show the importance of accurate, accessible weather forecasts.
Just know that whenever the Weather Service sends out a warning, it's because there's something there that is making us concerned.
Then our astronomy contributor shares the myths behind some of our solar system's most famous moons.
I think it's so interesting that our solar system, our own little solar system, one star, eight planets, has such a wide variety of different worlds.
And we'll go to the beach to talk about the science you can find in the sand. All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks so much for joining us. Last year, before the election, Lake Effect explored the impact of immigration here in Milwaukee. The special was called Fear is the Point. Today, as the Trump administration continues its campaign aimed at mass deportation, we're checking in with one of the guests who we talked to last year. Davorin Odercheck is an immigration lawyer in Milwaukee. He joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about what's changed since they last spoke.
So when last we spoke, you were questioning how much was going to change with the new Trump administration. Of course, you were a lawyer during the last Trump administration. We're about 6 months into the new administration. How have you seen things change?
I'm going to go on the record and say that when I last spoke to you, I think I was quite naive. And let me just tell you that I'm not surprised by the significant changes that have happened during the past 6 months, but I will admit that I've been caught flat-footed. And part of that was that my only frame of reference was Trump 1.0. And Trump 2.0 is completely different from Trump 1.0. Trump 1.0 was much closer to the Biden and Obama years. This is something completely different.
When you say completely different, what does that look like on the ground?
Let me just backpedal and just tell you that the Immigration and Nationality Act is, I wouldn't call it a pro-immigrant friendly body of law. The Immigration and Nationality Act is designed to really keep out more people than to allow people in. And sometimes it can be just a stacked deck against the immigrant. So that's always been around. What has happened is that this administration has taken some tools, so to speak, within the Immigration and Nationality Act, and they've ran with it in ways that I just haven't seen. And I could give you some very concrete examples. So there's a provision in, I'm going to say INA for purposes of brevity. There's a section within the INA that allows Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE officers, to issue their own expedited removal orders if this individual has been essentially found inadmissible and they haven't been here for more than 2 years. And this part of the law has been around since 1997. It just hasn't ever really been utilized for almost 30 years now. And so the Trump administration is taking this, and this is what they're doing. There are individuals that are in immigration court who have filed for asylum. They haven't been here for very long. They've been going to immigration court. They go to their hearing. The government lawyer for the Department of Homeland Security files a motion to dismiss, and the immigration judge grants it. Immigrants, a little bit confused. I was in immigration court. I was in deportation proceedings, and now it's dismissed. I don't know. Is this a good thing or bad thing? It's very confusing. They walk out of the courthouse or the courtroom, and then right there in the hallway is an ICE officer that's like, oh, time to take you. I'm going to detain you, and I'm going to put you into expedited removal. And so this is a mechanism to essentially try to remove as many people as possible without having that person's case be adjudicated fully by an immigration judge. And that's something that is new in my 18 years.
So these are people who are going to their appointments, essentially going to their court dates. following the procedure who are then being deported or detained, at least, as a result of following the rules?
Well, going to their immigration court hearing, exactly. They have certain tools, like I said, within the INA, and they're just taking it to a level that I've not seen. And that goes also with arrest and detentions. And I think that's something that might be surprising for a lot of people about how quite easy it is for ICE to arrest pretty much anyone who they believe is here in violation of immigration law.
Now, it should be noted that people facing deportation are not guaranteed representation. Who are your clients generally?
Well, I have a mishmash, I should say, of clients. Most of my clients in immigration court have been here for a significantly longer time. To be upfront, a lot of them do have some sort of arrest or conviction record, but they're eligible for some kind of application to be able to remain here.
Have you noticed the administration more aggressively pursuing deportation specifically for the people you're representing?
Yes and no. And that's sort of a – I sometimes kind of joke about this. Since many of my clients do have some sort of conviction record, they always have a target on their back. It doesn't matter whether it's under the Obama or Biden administration. So in some ways, I always have clients that are just sort of seen as a priority. I have had, though, recently a client who was – still in immigration court proceedings, has been in immigration court proceedings for a while, is married to a U.S. citizen, he's got two U.S. citizen kids. He was bonded out from custody, I think, about 8 years ago. And he was detained again because he had last year like a theft citation. Like, so not a criminal conviction, but like a retail theft citation. Not the best thing to have at this point. But also the grand scheme of things, not the most serious of offenses, especially since it was never treated criminally. It was just treated like a civil ordinance violation. So at any rate, in January, the Lake and Riley Act passed. And the Lake and Riley Act expanded the scope of mandatory detention, where anyone who has just simply been arrested, for example, for retail theft, not convicted, they could be subject to mandatory immigration detention. And that was sort of the basis for ICE to basically take him in. I successfully argued that the Lake and Riley Act doesn't retroactively apply to anything prior to its enactment in January. And so he was given a $6,000 bond and released. But that's sort of kind of an example of kind of the new thing. Regarding detention, I think the bigger concern is how they're really appearing to detain people that have, like, no record whatsoever. And one of the things that has surprised me, and there's been several documented reports in the media about this, someone is, like, a visa overstay. So they came in on a business visa, they overstayed. So, yeah, technically they're deportable in the sense that they violated immigration law. But they also filed for adjustment of status. They're married to a U.S. citizen. They've come forward by filing an application, which essentially acknowledges, yes, I am here, and yes, I am here in violation of the law, but I have a basis to be here now through this permanent resident application. And prior to this administration, there was essentially like an unwritten rule that ICE would just leave these folks alone because they have come forward. They're in the process of applying for adjustment status affirmatively, so they're going through the process. USCIS will ultimately make a decision on it. And so they just weren't touched. And so that does not appear to be the case. If ICE becomes aware of someone that's a visa overstay, like for instance at the airport in Puerto Rico or Hawaii or wherever, they are now detaining folks like that who would otherwise just be left alone because they're in the process of pursuing permanent residence. And that's a significant change. That's not something I anticipated.
Yeah. Well, it seems, at least from the outside of this system, that it would encourage people to break the law more because They're not going to necessarily go through these proceedings if they know that by trying to follow the laws, they will be detained and deported. It seems like that would be a rational response.
That is definitely a concern of mine when it comes to people that have immigration court hearings or even hearings in state court.
When you hear the administration talking about focusing on denaturalization now, that is the process of removing legal status, a naturalized citizen's status, in order to deport them. When you hear the administration talking about that, what does that say to you as someone who works in immigration law?
Well, I think that they're essentially trying to make it so that no one really is safe. So, you know, usually when someone naturalizes, that's the final chapter, right? And now they are of equal standing. And I've had the pleasure of attending multiple ceremonies when clients have invited me. Some of these ceremonies are quite moving. There's something just makes you feel good inside. Obviously, this is something that hasn't yet materialized, but we're obviously kind of concerned about what they have in store. What I've noticed is that, I guess how I'd kind of summarize what I'm seeing is that really the off-the-charts hateful rhetoric towards immigrants, the policies and actions have finally matched that.
Well, Dov, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you.
Davrin Odercheck is an immigration lawyer in Milwaukee, and he spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. You can find more interviews with immigration lawyers about changes they are seeing in immigration enforcement in our series, The Check-In, at wuwm.com. The Trump administration has made deep staffing cuts to the National Weather Service. Those cuts are under additional scrutiny after deadly flash floods in central Texas. To learn more about what the National Weather Service does in Wisconsin, WUWM's Jimmy Gutierrez visited Milwaukee's NWS office. He spoke with Tim Halbach, a warning coordination meteorologist there.
What exactly does the National Weather Service do, and then how do you get that information out to people who could be in the path of a weather event or just want more information on what is happening with the weather?
So our role, we're part of the federal government. So our job is to collect data and information and then try to process what we think is going to happen. So with forecast models, that's our best way to be able to predict the weather. So we use that to be able to put together the most likely scenario and tell people, here's what we think is going to happen. Here are the different scenarios which could occur. Gathering that information and then putting out warnings is our primary job that we do. So everything starts with us. So as soon as we click send on a tornado warning, that's what triggers the sirens to go off, people's phones to alert. Our other main role is being involved with support for partners. So it's called decision support services. That's something that's more internal, like working with the school districts. So the school district superintendent that needs to cancel school because there's a winter storm coming, we're providing them with briefings at 3 a.m. To let them know what the latest is on the winter storm so that in 2 hours they can call everybody and say, hey, school's off today. So helping out anybody that's involved with public safety is where our role is. So a lot of just trying to keep people safe and let them know what's going to happen with the weather.
And you said you've been in this role for 10 years here and you've been with the service for 20 years. How have things changed over that time? Because I'm curious about how forecasting actually keeps people safe, which I don't think a lot of us think about or realize. It's just, okay, we have weather alerts or we have our forecast, but what have you seen change and how does that affect how folks are safe?
20 years ago when I first started, it was a lot of meteorologists trying to beat the weather models. Like our goal was to try to be a little bit better than what the NGM model or, and there really wasn't a whole lot of this decision support services, helping partners make decisions. It was a lot of very hands-off. In fact, a long time ago, Summerfest folks called us because they had a bunch of storms back in like the 2000s and asked for information, and we flat out told them, like, we can't help you out. So that's completely flipped, I would say, in the last 10 years. We had this moment where 2011 was a really bad year for tornadoes. Joplin, Alabama had a lot of killer tornadoes that occurred, and it was kind of a soul-searching spot for us because we just lost all these people, and we had warnings, we had forecasts. What are we doing wrong? And the answer was, we need to be more directly talking with people that help keep people safe. So that's been the biggest thing that's changed in the Weather Service in terms of forecasting. The models that we have and the information to make decisions has gotten a lot better. So when it comes to tornado situations, we had the Dodge County tornadoes a couple months ago. We had updated forecast model information every 30 minutes. And we could actually see that there's going to be this uptick in storm activity in Dodge County. And that allowed us to focus in that, hey, if something starts going there, like, we got to really be on the game to get out warnings faster. So right now, our warnings, our goal is about like 10 minutes of heads up to people. In the future, within the next few years here, with the research that's being done, you know, we could start looking at like an hour or two of just people getting a heads up that you're more likely to get a tornado than this person here. So that's the cool stuff that's coming down, because our confidence is a lot higher in what we're doing. And when we're doing these warnings, we're very sure that something is happening there.
You touched on the flood situations in the state. And I know a lot of people are thinking about NWS right now because of what happened over in Texas and Kerrville, and what's still happening in Texas. If a situation like that were to happen 3-4 in the morning, as they had, what can people expect to hear? How does that information come to you at National Weather Service, our local NWS, and then out to the public?
The way we approach any severe weather event is just trying to tell the story of what we think is going to occur with the severe weather event. So if it's a flooding situation overnight, like they just had in Texas, we'd be ramping that up, thinking about what are the vulnerable people in this situation that need to take a little bit more preventative measures, that if the warnings do come out, you know, what do you need to do? So it's hard because sometimes we'll forecast this over and over again and then nothing happens and people kind of let their guard down. But just know that whenever the Weather Service sends out a warning, it's because there's something there that is making us concerned. So we don't just toss those out. Everything that we're looking at says something's potentially there. And then as it gets worse and worse, our confidence goes up and we start leveling it up and saying, hey, it's really, really bad.
You've been in this role for 10 years. Are there memorable weather events that stick out to you in Wisconsin and Southeast Wisconsin too, as the tornadoes infringe on Milwaukee? I don't think, as someone who's been in the city for a little bit, I haven't experienced them in the city, but around the city, or big weather events that kind of stick with you and the role that you all played in getting that information out to the public?
Yeah, one of my earlier career situations was back in 2008, we had the tornadoes that went through southeastern Wisconsin in January through Wheatland, far southeastern Wisconsin, Kenosha County. I was working in the Chicago office at the time where those storms initiated in McHenry County. And for me, that was a situation where, you know, it's off season, people aren't prepared for that. I remember going into work that day, leaving my house and be like, oh man, it's super hot, it's humid, like, this is not good. And as soon as I walked in the afternoon, we were putting out tornado warnings. So that day sticks out to me because it relates back to February of last year when we had tornadoes in southwestern Wisconsin. And it was kind of a similar situation where people got the warnings and they reacted to it. Everybody that I talked to on that path said, yeah, I got the warnings and I got into the shelter. That to me is like, that's why we're here. That's why we're let people know that something bad is coming their way. There are times, though, talking with some people in Dodge County when we just had the recent tornadoes, there were a lot of people I talked to that said, I didn't know there was a tornado coming, even though we had the warnings out. So one of the main things that we've followed up and told people is making sure you have the wireless emergency alerts on your phone ready to go, because it's the number one thing, after I've talked with people that have been hit by a tornado, that they had on their phone and they were doing something else in the garage, or they were doing something else and it kind of snap them into like, hey, you know, something's going on here. So if you've turned them off in the past for whatever reason, you know, we don't judge, but you know, get those things back on, because it's really the best way to get weather information, warning information in a short amount of time.
So our local National Weather Service office is in Dousman, which is a bit of a drive from downtown Milwaukee. But pulling up to the offices, besides driving through these picturesque meadows, there was something else that caught my eye, and I wanted to know more about it. All right, can we step outside real quick? Because there was something I saw on our drive out here that I was really curious about. Yep. This large white ball in the sky that you all have.
It's typically what the kids will call our big soccer ball or water tower looking thing.
Yeah. But
it's our Doppler radar that we have. So I don't know how many hundreds of feet up in on top of the hill it is, but that's our best tool to be able to monitor where storms are. There's a big satellite dish looking thing inside that that spins around, and it sends out a pulse of energy, and then it sits and listens for that energy to get reflected back to the radar. And based on how much and how long it took to do that, it'll paint it out on a map. So all the radar apps and everything that you use that information to be able to show where storms are.
All right, you have so many toys.
I know, it's fun. It doesn't feel like work sometimes because it is.
Okay, fully entering show and tell mode, I also wanted to know more about another space. It looked kind of like the brain of the station. A bunch of scientists sitting in front of ever-changing radars, making sense of whatever it is that they're seeing for people like me.
So this is our operations area. We always have at least one person here. When we have severe weather or any kind of bad weather in the forecast, we'll have more people working. Severe weather days, it'll be pretty full of people. Kind of depends on how widespread the weather is going to be or how bad, how much extra people we need. So typically how we split it up is on a normal day-to-day basis, one person's doing the forecasting. Today that's Taylor, who's sitting here right in front of you. She's putting a lot of focus on what's happening right now through the next day. Okay. Something that people might not know, we do the forecast for the airports and also for all of Lake Michigan, the open waters for that. So we help provide hour-by-hour updates through the next 24 to 36 hours for the airports.
Okay. Something that Tim couldn't get into is what the federal cuts meant for the National Weather Service, how it's going to affect the work that they do, their staffing, their technology, all of the things. So I called someone who could talk about it.
I'm Paul Rober. I'm a distinguished professor emeritus at University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. And that simply means I retired in May.
The dream that I don't know if any millennial will see. When it comes to weather, and especially weather in Wisconsin, there's not much that Paul does not know. He said to understand the National Weather Service and the impact of these cuts, you need to understand what he called the last mile.
What is meant by the last mile is we do all this stuff up front to produce as technically good a weather forecast as we possibly can. And we've done a lot of things over the years to do that, the numerical models, et cetera, the observation systems, all of that goes into it. That's all the technical side of thing. But if you can't communicate that information to the people who need to hear it, then it doesn't matter. All that effort is useless because they're not going to act on it. The weather event's going to happen anyway, regardless of how good your forecast was. For example, in the hill country in Texas, in that flood, there's a lot of elevation there. And so if people had acted on that information, if they'd even heard it, they could have gone to higher elevation. In fact, I read somewhere that several hundred people in those camps actually did go to higher ground and were safe. And so it's pretty clear that the people who didn't go to higher ground, they were at the areas that were the most susceptible to the flood, closest to the river. And it's not clear that anybody actually evacuated, but it's sort of in a situation where there are different places where people are staying and some are at higher elevation than others. And so they just were lucky enough to be in those places to avoid it. That's an example of a last mile, right? Where you want to get those people who are adjacent to the river out of there as fast as possible. And they had several hours to do it, which is remarkable given what we're able to do just a few years ago, to give people several hours of lead time to be able to get themselves out of harm's way is a fabulous accomplishment for the technical side of things.
What do these cuts mean to the services provided, the technology that the NWS has and relies on, and what does it mean for resident safety overall?
So it's really a complicated answer because, you know, for example, in any particular instant, it's a little hard to say exactly what happened in terms of the forecast or how people respond to the forecast, which is why I was using that flood as an example of how that plays out. It's a pretty good example of how operations can be impacted. It doesn't include all the impacts, though, because, for example, a number of offices that have been understaffed have stopped launching weather balloons or not launching them as frequently as they used to. And that's a fundamental data set. It's actually not replaceable currently by any other technologies. You can imagine if you have the holes in these observations that the forecasts are sometimes going to suffer from that. You know, another issue is that some offices, because of understaffing again, can't operate 24/7. They just don't have enough people to do that. That's obviously a big problem. A lot of weather happens at night. And in fact, that's when it's the most deadly, typically, because most of the time people are sleeping and not hearing weather warnings, if there are any that are out there. So not having that capability is obviously a huge operational limitation. Now, what's been happening recently is the federal government has been backing up on what it did before in terms of losing so many people and has started to rehire people. That's a process that's ongoing. So, you know, effectively, they took the hammer to the system to some extent, and now they said, oops, maybe we shouldn't have done that. And so they're trying to fill back. But my understanding, my interpretation from kind of reading between the lines of what people have said, I think their view is that we can leverage technology to reduce personnel in the Weather Service and presumably other parts of the government also. And by doing so, of course, people are the most expensive item in any budget that you have. So if you can lose some people without damaging whatever it is you're trying to do, sure, that's fine, sort of. But it's not clear that you can actually do that effectively in the Weather Service operation.
That was Paul Rober, Professor Emeritus of Atmospheric Science at UWM. You also heard from Tim Halbach from Milwaukee's National Weather Service Office. They both spoke with WUWM's Jimmy Gutierrez. Did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. Later on in the show, we'll learn about the many lives of Havenwood State Forest in northwest Milwaukee. But first, we'll learn about moons in our solar system and which have evidence of the key to life, water. Stay tuned to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Earth's moon is visible most nights and is one of the few astronomical objects that we can see comfortably without a telescope. But our solar system is full of more interesting moons. Some even have captivating Greek myths associated with them. From fiery Io to icy Europa, the Manfred Olson Planetarium has a whole program dedicated to moons and myths. To share more about it, I'm joined by the planetarium's director and our regular astronomy contributor, Jean Creighton. Jean, welcome back to Lake Effect.
So good to be with you, Audrey.
For your show this month, Moons and Myths, you're going far beyond Earth's moon, right? Which, you know, maybe we give it too much attention because I feel like we're not even thinking about other moons most of the time. So why did you want to like explore beyond our lunar neighbor specifically?
Well, I should say right away that we do talk a little bit about the moon. After all, we're hoping to send people to the moon soon. And for most people, the moon is the only astronomical object that they can comfortably see without a telescope or binoculars, right? But we wanted to talk about moons because it gives us an opportunity to talk about what we know about these interesting moons, which we're about to explore as well. But also it gives me a chance to say myths, which I associate with summer. I grew up in Greece, as you know, and maybe some of our listeners know. And to me, one of my favorite activities in the summertime was to read these beautiful books about Greek mythology. And I love finding opportunities to throw in a myth where possible.
Absolutely. So while we're on the note of Greek myths associated with moons, do you want to share a favorite of yours?
Oh, sure. So the Olympian gods, right, are the 12 gods like Zeus and Hera, people have heard perhaps before. But what they don't know is that there was a huge battle to see who is going to be the rulers of the world. And the Olympian gods fought for 12 years with the Titans. So that's, you know, the powerful, big gods. And in the end, the Olympian gods won. Now, I had an opportunity recently. I went to Greece recently with my son, and we visited the area called Meteora. Meteora is the same word, like root, that meteors have, right? So you go to this otherwise flat valley, and there are these huge chunks of rock that stick out. And the myth has it that those were the Titans that got tossed from Olympus, and there they stand. Fun. Anyway, so Titan then is one of the largest, most important moon of Saturn. And it was super exciting that in 2004, a small probe called Huygens was thrown into the atmosphere of Titan, because Titan has an atmosphere full of organic goodies. And yes, we have not found life there. But in 2004, that probe landed on the surface of Titan, and that is the farthest thing that humans have ever landed anywhere.
That's pretty incredible.
I hope you can hear the excitement. This is so awesome. So there is Titan. Now, because we have taken pictures and other things, and we see cool features on Titan that look like lakes, some of them are as big as the Great Lakes, we have a cycle that isn't made of water now, but is made of hydrocarbons. So what makes natural gas? It's cold enough on Titan that these things liquefy. Now that we've talked a bit about Titan and I told you about their myth, we're going to move to other moons that are around Jupiter. Now those are super exciting, especially Europa. And if Europa sounds familiar, the continent of Europe is named after Europa. But for that, you'll need to hear the story in the planetarium. The Europa is exciting because its surface is made of ice. And we have looked at pictures. The ice has cracks, and we see water vapor coming out of these worlds. There could be potentially life in them right now. There are two spacecraft going to Europa. They're going to arrive around 2030. And although we don't expect that we'll be able to determine whether there's life or not in them, we certainly will be able to get better data as to whether there's a liquid ocean under that crust. How exciting that even in our own solar system, there could be good conditions for life right now.
Yeah, and you know, we think about exploring our solar system, and it's a lot of emphasis is put on the atmosphere of planets, but you're talking about some pretty dramatic surfaces of moons, certainly compared to our own, right? What are some of the other more famous moons in the solar system, at least to you, because of their dramatic surfaces and the possibility of further exploring them?
Well, Io is definitely another one, which is on the other side of the world, like other side of the spectrum. So we went from super cool and cold worlds to now a super hot world. When Io was first photographed with the Voyager missions, rates, the data would come in from space was super slow, right? So an image wasn't a poof, it was a line by line by line. So when that line by line, they started looking at it and thought, gee, this looks like a pizza. And, you know, the cheese and the olives, all of that. So it's sort of fondly and formally called a pizza moon. This is a world that's so close to Jupiter that its interior is kept molten. And there are volcanoes. So this is the most actively volcanic world in the whole solar system.
That's wild.
Yeah. Yes. And I don't imagine really that we think that Io is a great place for life to be. But I think it's so interesting that our solar system, our own little solar system, one star, eight planets, has such a wide variety of different worlds.
Absolutely. I'm intrigued to learn more about a lot of the moons. So if people are wanting to know more, you have this show throughout the month as well. But for today, thank you for joining me, Jean, to share more about moons and myths.
Thank you so much, Audrey.
Jean Creighton is the director of UW-Milwaukee's Manfred Olson Planetarium and our regular astronomy contributor. The planetarium's Moons and Myths program is every Friday starting tomorrow through August 1st. You can find more information and explore our previous conversations about astronomy at wuwm.com.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
I'm WUWM's Emily Files. I recently tagged along on a field trip in a forest with first and second graders from Milwaukee's Atonement Lutheran School.
We'll be looking at animal homes, animal tracks. Look for animals, see how they move. You'll probably see some squirrels and birds and stuff out there.
Turns out it was bugs that students got most excited about.
Oh yeah, there's another spider right there.
The kids were hiking in a 237-acre nature preserve, and they only traveled a couple miles to find it. Haven Woods off Silver Spring Drive and Sherman is the only urban state forest in Wisconsin. A Bubbler Talk listener wondered why Haven Woods was created. The history of the forest is one of punishment and war. What started as farmland in the 1800s became Milwaukee County's House of Correction in the early 20th century. The Army seized it in 1945 to use as disciplinary barracks, which briefly held prisoners of war. Then, from 1956 to 63, during the Cold War, it was a Nike anti-aircraft missile site.
Really a lost part of the city.
That's Gaylord Yost, a retired forester who moved to this neighborhood in 1975. By then, the disciplinary barracks were empty.
It was just roughly abandoned property. Mostly it was grassed over, trees, brush.
Residents rallied to turn the blight into a nature preserve. Yost joined them as part of the Friends of Haven Woods group, which was led by environmentalist Carrie Backus.
Carrie Backus wanted it as a gem up here in the northwest corner and an environmental inspiration of what can happen to a well-used, abandoned property like that.
The environmentalists got the attention of politicians, including Wisconsin Governor Martin Schreiber. He offered for the Department of Natural Resources to take over the property from the city. The transfer happened in 1978.
It's a healing process. This is now decades worth of restoration, revegetation projects.
Angela Vicchio is superintendent for Milwaukee State Parks. She says people use the 6 miles of trails here for hiking, dog walking, and bird watching.
We are doing something positive where this didn't necessarily have a highly positive past. There were a lot of things that were controversial in it. And, you know, I think it's a to our benefit to ensure that this continues to be a positive space for people to come.
The forest is in a predominantly Black community, and Vicchio says there's work to be done to better engage those neighbors. One group already doing that work is Nearby Nature, run by Stephen Hunter. He brings school children to Haven Woods for nature education.
We're nearby nature, right? So, you know, we hear from our white counterparts, oh, we went to Door County, we went to these places that are outlying spaces, and like, well, okay. Those are access conversations. But like state, you know, Haven Woods provides that same level of access, like right here in the city.
Vicchio hopes that gets more people here to experience the benefits of nature.
You hear birds chirping, you hear crickets, you hear the wind moving between the leaves on the trees. And just to spend time to quiet your mind can really be useful in urban areas.
After decades serving various military and punitive purposes, Haven Woods is now a quiet sanctuary, or a haven.
Support for Bubbler Talk comes from Educators Credit Union. What have you always wanted to know about the Milwaukee area? Visit wuwm.com/bubblertalk to submit your question.
We'll take one more break, and when we come back, we'll go to the beach to learn about science. Keep listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Summer is in full swing, and before we close out today's show, we are going to the beach, where the sun is shining, kids are screaming, and there's also lots to learn. Our guide is Hannah Wege, a professor of chemistry at Wisconsin Lutheran College. She joins WUWM's Lena Tran to talk about all the science you can find when you're playing in the sand.
I meet Hannah Wege at South Beach Park in Port Washington. We don't even make it past the parking lot before she notices a butterfly. Its upper wings are streaked with orange and black, like a tiger, and the underside of its wings are all warm browns and grays, with spots that look like eyes. The butterfly floats up to greet her and lands on her finger. Just one of the many wonders that Hannah hunts for when she's at the beach. Wonders that she says you can train yourself to notice, and wonders that enrich your experience of the world around you.
When I do a nature walk, I'm always observing and trying to look for interesting things. So when I'm at the beach, I'm often looking for fossils. Fossils are everywhere. People should know this. You can just sit down and dig, and you can find fossils everywhere on the beach.
So this is what Hannah does at the beach. She zooms in, observes, uses all her senses. She says she's the kind of person who prefers the rigor of the school year to endless summer days. So when she's at the beach, she likes the structure of paying attention.
Yeah, it does give me a sense of mission, gives me a purpose. And again, as a scientist, I mean, I'm always like trying to ask questions and trying to observe. I think one of the things I realized as I like walk down a beach or something like that, it's different every time I go. It's different every time I go. And I'm different every time I go. But you only notice that if you're noticing it, or if you're like looking closely at what's around you. So that's
what I wanted to talk to Hannah about. What kinds of things can we learn from a walk on the beach? Of course, she is a chemistry professor, so she has some knowledge about the beach and Lake Michigan that makes even the sand between our toes seem special. We're both wearing sandals.
Sand is made up of a variety of things, but largely it's comprised of silica, which is the mineral form of the molecule silicon dioxide. Mixed in with the sand, of course, there would be other like shells, which would be calcium carbonate. The way we use silica is we melt, that's why sand is a component in glass. That silicon dioxide is like window pane glass. But there are actually creatures that eat sand, which I think is kind of mind-blowing. Cyanobacteria actually will eat through silicon dioxide, so grains of sand, so these tiny microbes. It seems like they're scavenging for things like iron and manganese. But also, once the sand has been sort of eaten through and released as individual molecules, other creatures, diatoms in particular, actually use that silicon dioxide, those little molecules that make up sand, to create their exoskeleton. And they have these like really lacy patterns that form sort of a cage. And so if you were able to look really closely at the sand under a microscope, you would not only see little jagged pieces of quartz and silica, you would see these intricate patterns made of glass. It's like a glass house that it makes for itself.
And all this stuff is constantly on the move. The sand you take a nap on, the stuff that gets stuck in your shoes and hair.
Those grains of sand were eroded from bedrock, like at the bottom of the lake. So wind and waves abrade the rock and create little pieces of sand, which is what washes up on the shore. Once it gets to shore, it continues to move with the wind. We're in Port Washington, so there's big bluffs. So the little pieces of sand, the little pieces of silt and clay that travel the furthest end up on the bluffs. And so what's underneath you at the sand is always moving. It's always new. It's always being renewed. Either
heavy rain can speed things up, make things move faster. It's something we can see now as climate change brings more intense precipitation to the Great Lakes. A couple years ago, there was a landslide in Port Washington. Rain had soaked the mud and clay until it was too heavy for the bluff to hold. This was on North Beach, one of Hannah's favorite spots on Lake Michigan. She and her kids went to another park up on the bluffs to check out the landslide from above.
The reddish clay kind of tumbled down the bluffs and just completely like wiped out the path.
And looking further back, how was all of this created? You know, where did it come from?
The bedrock that's at the bottom of the Great Lakes basins, they are volcanic in origin. And of course, in order to get these little pieces of sand that we see on the beaches today, glaciers came through and carved out the basins for the Great Lakes. And then those little pieces of rock that got eroded by the glaciers is what we see as sand. And these are like movable pieces of silicon dioxide now.
Yeah, I love that. In Wisconsin, everything always comes back to the glaciers.
Oh, yeah. Oh, for sure. Yes. Yeah. We are only here because they carved out this place for us.
What does it look like? Hannah says she wasn't always this way. She grew up in Wisconsin, enjoying Lake Michigan, a lot like her kids do now, scrambling on bluffs and splashing in the water. But now her walks have this focus to them. She's contemplative and observant. She notices what's changed and has her eyes out for things she's maybe never seen before. She searches milkweed plants for caterpillars and hunts for agates, gems that contain bands of color painted by the lake. For her, things kind of shifted when she was in graduate school, getting her PhD in chemistry.
I was, you know, sort of in the midst of my science training and also starting a family. And so I was like really slowed down during that like period of time where I was like studying something really, really intently in graduate school, where I was like doing this really intense observation. And of course, having small children, you just can't move very quickly. And so trying to get outside with my children and spending time just resulted in me having to slow down. And I think that's really when the sort of world of science all around me sort of opened up, and also sort of being trained to observe really closely sort of like coalesced. So I was definitely a grown-up. Like by the time I sort of had this attitude of going to the beach and like really looking and observing.
Being a mom and then being a scientist, both of those things are like huge learning curves in their own way.
Absolutely.
And they just happened at the same time.
They did. Yeah. I chose to have children in graduate school, which again was kind of an odd thing to do. That's not something a lot of people choose. But it was a really very special time for me. And yeah, it really brought me new perspectives in two different ways at the same time.
Hannah's kids are also teaching her new ways to see the water. A couple years ago, after they'd all gaped at the wreckage of the landslide, they came back down to South Beach, and Hannah's daughter made this observation.
As we were looking for fossils on the beach, she recognized, she said, no one has ever seen these rocks before. they are new every time we come. And she's absolutely right that it's just fascinating to think that a pebble that you pick up on the beach may never have been viewed by a human before. It had been unearthed, like, from the depths of the bedrock, you know, on the floor of the lake. And so it's just, even though it's ancient, it's new.
After Hannah and I say goodbye, she walks back across the beach to the parking lot. I notice while she's walking, her eyes are trained down on the sand. Who knows what she might see? For Lake Effect, I'm Lena Tran.
That was Lena Tran speaking with Hannah Wege, a professor of chemistry at Wisconsin Lutheran College, last summer. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers, Sam Woods, and X-Grit Nunez join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Rob Larry and Graham Thomas. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. Emily Files helps edit the show. We also heard from Jimmy Gutierrez, Mayan Silver, and Taryn Powell from the WUWM news team this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager. Valeria Navarra-Viegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, simply download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts. Join us again on Monday at noon for a Capitol Notes conversation about Wisconsin's state budget. Plus, we'll go behind the scenes with a local author to learn more about the making of the film Summer Stock. Thanks so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.